Allow myself to introduce myself.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, self and self-presentation.
How many yous have you been?
So typical of Bart. All he thinks about is himself.
How different can we make our public personas from our private selves?
Steven, any thought of running for political office yourself?
No, no, absolutely none. I have said terrible things with a straight face on camera. Can you imagine the political ads that could be run against me? Can you imagine?
Who decides what my persona is, me or the rest of you?
Our guest is Susan Heckman from the University of Texas at Arlington.
Self and self-presentation. Philosophy.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW, San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner at Stanford. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for a long time.
40 years, I think it was. John, today we're thinking about the self and self-representation.
Well, those are two different things, I think. When I think about the self, what I mostly think about is metaphysics, the metaphysics of persons, what makes for a single person and self-identity. I want to know exactly what a self is, and I want to know what distinguishes one self from another.
And when you think about self-presentation?
Well, then it seems to me you're probably talking psychology or maybe politics or marketing or something like that. I mean, it's a fine topic, but it has to do with how we present ourselves to other people and to ourselves, so what properties we emphasize. It's not about who we or what we really are in and of ourselves.
You know, John, you sound a little Cartesian there, dude.
Oh, no. Descartes believed in immaterial souls, and he took the self to be one of those. I want no part of that.
Yeah, but the thing is, you seem to believe that the self is a thing, you know, unto itself, with a nature independent of how it's perceived or presented. I'm not sure I believe that anymore. I think that maybe for the self, it might just be that to be is to be perceived, to be presented.
Ah, I see your problem, big guy. You're confusing the me with the I.
Oh, and you're throwing George Herbert Mead at me, aren't you?
Well, Mead's distinction is very important. The me, that's what others treat me as. It's how they see me. The I is the inner self. It's really more how I see myself, or maybe how I really am, even if I don't quite understand myself.
But things aren't as simple as Mead wanted to make out. I never was convinced. Cause, well, partly, think of all the different contexts in which we have to present ourselves. The workplace, the political arena, the family, social media. And in these different contexts, we reveal and conceal different things about ourselves.
Well, how does that show that there's no such thing as one true self? It certainly doesn't refute the idea that there can be a gap between what you really are and what you present yourself as being.
But my question is, where do you catch a glimpse of this true inner self? Where can you observe the self, you know, raw, unfiltered, and unadulterated? Do you retreat to a desert island, John? Do you peer incessantly at your own navel? How do you do it, John?
Boy, you're confused.
You're throwing Mead back at me again? Is that what you want to do?
Well, not quite, but it's related. But now I think you're drifting into being confused about the difference between social identity, you know, that's kind of what we present ourselves as being, and personal identity, what makes us the same person from time to time.
Why don't you enlighten me and our listeners, oh, wise one, about this distinction?
Okay, ask yourself, what makes Ken Taylor count as the very same person again and again at different times and different places? When I first knew you, you were young and full of awe for me, and now you've changed remarkably, right? You're old, and that's a question about personal identity. What makes you the same through all those changes in personality and physique? Personal identity doesn't depend on anything social. It's metaphysical. Ken Taylor alone on a desert island with no one around to perceive him would still be Ken Taylor.
Okay, I get that. And now social identity? What are you talking about there?
Well, that's a matter of the social markers by which you and others identify you. What you think about is important about yourself and what they think is important about you. Markers that assign meaning and social significance to your acts and choices. It's part of your social identity, Ken, that you're an African-American, a heterosexual, a philosopher, and a lifelong Democrat,
okay.
I assume.
Okay, but tell me this. How do these facts about personal identity constrain or relate to facts about social identity?
Well, not all that much. I mean, you would surely be the same you in the sense of personal identity, even if you were not straight, black, or even the most basic. A Democrat.
Well, what if I weren't male? What if I weren't a person of color? Could I still be the very same person?
Well, those are difficult questions. The politically correct answer is yes, and I'm inclined to think that's the right answer.
Well, let me ask you that. Let me ask you, listen, when we talk about the real self, are we talking about something at the level of social identity or something at the level of personal identity?
Well, sometimes one, sometimes the other. No clear answer.
Well, bear with me for a second. Let's follow this out. Suppose that the real self is social. Isn't it then bound to be variable and multiple in all these ways? But then how could any one of these variable and multiple social identities have a greater claim to being my real self than any other of them?
Well, I think you should conclude that the real self is not a social self, but is prior to all merely social identities.
Well, that's what I was trying to get you to say. But now I've got a different worry. I worry that the real self is just an empty shell. It's devoid of all content. It's unable to provide any concrete guidance as to what I am or to do or to be or to present myself as in the social world.
Well, you're about to conclude that the real self is just a philosopher's fiction. Or that the self is little more than an arbitrary bundle of poses and personae that you put on and take off at will. How very pomo of you, Ken.
I'm not quite sure I want to go all the way there, but you do have to admit, John, that the real self is at least a tiny bit elusive, don't you, dude?
Well, I can hardly deny that. And to help us track down the real self, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, out to find out when people are at their most veiled and their most raw. She files this report.
Politicians can be good at saying one thing and doing another. Like in 2014, when Republican Representative Paul Ryan dumped water on Mitt Romney's head during the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge.
Hey, buddy.
Hey, how you doing?
How are you doing?
Not good.
That is cold.
Thing is, 3 years earlier, Paul Ryan had voted for legislation that defunded millions in ALS research. And it's not just politicians. We all have a time, a place, a situation where we aren't really our authentic selves. We do something because others are doing it, like pour buckets of cold water over people's heads. We veil our true identities to blend in with the crowd. So I asked a few folks, when are you the least real you?
I was probably my least authentic self working in restaurants as a server. People get upset when you're serving them, and even if you feel like they're in the wrong, you really have to hold back.
Sometimes if I was in the company of a large group of people at a bar and everyone's drinking and I don't feel like drinking or necessarily even telling jokes or having fun, then I feel least like my true self.
I remember feeling even the positive moments where I would get along with a customer, I still felt like I wasn't actually, that wasn't really me, or that I was holding back. You know, there was such a separation between the server and the people being served.
People that I don't hang out with just to hang out with, but there's always some activity going on.
I asked those same people, when are you your most authentic self?
I guess at home with my family.
Either working out or dancing or somewhere where I don't have to be talking with people.
If somebody's suffering or the loss of a parent or a loved one and you have to be supported or support that person, I feel like that's when you just don't really think about what's going to make you look good.
I told a friend that I'm my truest self with my son and husband. Then she asked me, so what self were you before they were around? Good point. Who is my true self?
I don't think there's a quote-unquote true self, because I think the moment you would define a true self, it would almost be too confining already.
Lucky for me, there's a ton of online quizzes to help. so I took one.
Which color do you like the best?
Red.
What foods do you like the most?
Salty?
Which hairstyle is best on a girl?
Seriously? I don't care.
Okay, this is your true self. You have a happy personality. You are going far in life. Don't let others push you around.
That makes absolutely no sense as a definition of a true self.
I know. I'm sorry.
Some things in life make us put on various masks, and others allow us to be more comfortable, more authentic, more our true selves. Even if we're not quite sure what true self really means. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka. Interesting insights about people's real selves and their not-so-real selves. I'm John Perry. I'm at my most real when I'm asleep. If I'm awake, I'm just mostly confused about who I am. But with me is someone who knows who he is, my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about self and self-presentation. We're joined now by Susan Heckman. She's a professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington. She's author of Private Selves, Public Identities, Reconsidering Identity Politics. Susan, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you very much.
Susan, you spent a significant portion of your life in the stormy waters of identity and identity politics and postmodern takes on identity and all sorts of things, private selves and public identities. How did you get interested in that? Some interesting schism between the two in your own life?
Oh, it's complicated, as are many things in life. I started reading postmodernism, particularly Judith Butler, who claims, as some of your comments have indicated, that there is no true self. It's all performative. You perform the scripts that you are given in society. It's fictive. And I really bought into that. And then a friend of mine asked me to edit a book on identity. And then I thought, you know, I ought to write a book on identity. And I was the stupidest decision I ever made. It is so unbelievably complicated. And what I tried to do is just to answer some of the questions that you've been throwing around. Is there a true self? And what I came up with is that everybody has two identities. You have a personal identity, which is you. Okay, not true, not metaphysical. It's what I call an ungrounded ground. It comes from all of the things, all of the social influences that have made you you, but it does give you a coherent self, and this is where I stand up to Butler. Who you are, right?
So it sounds like in the introduction you'd be a little bit more on my side and think that Ken was being maybe pernicious or maybe he was sincere, but at any rate, he was wrong. He was going off the deep end when he said there's no true self. So am I right about that?
There is no true self. I know this sounds contradictory, but I think I can defend it. There's no true self, but there's a coherent self. Okay? If you didn't have a coherent self, you would be in a mental institution. Okay? And in order to navigate your life, you have to have a sense of self.
Well, wait a minute. But I don't know how that answers the postmodern, because I still worry. Because the thing I asked John, and I was serious about this, I wasn't just being pernicious. So the people talk about the authentic self, the true self. You talk about the core self. But if that's socially constructed, right, as Judith Butler thinks selves, then you're almost bound to get into this fictive, multiple kind of thing.
Well,
but if it's not socially constructed and it's just there and prior to all social consciousness and social formation, then it's kind of empty. So either it's empty or it's fictive. I mean, it's...
What I try to do is to find a middle ground to that. I mean, forget metaphysics. I think metaphysics are just like not on the playing field anymore. But you developed a coherent you, and it is socially constructed. But as one of my favorite philosophers says, we construct ourselves out of a toolkit that's given to us by society, and we do make choices. But we do not determine the options among which we choose, Okay? So in other words, there is a middle ground. Okay, if we all just were socially constructed, we would all be the same, right? We would be social dupes, so that every woman would be like every other woman, and every African-American would be like every other African-American. What I'm trying to do is to carve out a middle ground between those two.
Okay, so Susan, we're going to have to explore this middle ground and whether it's a coherent middle ground. We'll do that beginning in our next segment. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about self and self-presentation with Susan Heckman from the University of Texas at Arlington.
Is there a gap between how you present yourself to others and what you really are? How do you catch a glimpse of your true self at its most raw and unfiltered? Or is the idea that there is such a thing as a one true self just an illusion?
The truth about the true self when Philosophy Talk continues.
John Lennon telling us he was the walrus, but he also said he's the Eggman. And he said that they are the Eggmen. This is pretty confusing. Who was John's true self? Did he even know before he met Yoko? Or did he forget when he met Yoko? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and today we're asking questions about identity, about private and public personas.
Our guest is Susan Heckman, author of Private Selves, Public Identities, Reconsidering Identity Politics.
So I want to start with social identities, public, what you call public identities, and the multiplicity of them, and then kind of work backwards into the what you call the core self. We all present ourselves in different ways in different contexts. There's no doubt about it. We do it one way at work, a different way at home, a different way when we're on the radio or running for public office. What determines how we present ourselves in a given context? Let's start with that question.
Well, I think there's two ways of answering it. One of them is to appeal to one of my favorite philosophers, Ludwig Wittgenstein, who talks about language games. Okay, yes, you're different. I'm different as a teacher. I'm different with my friends. I'm different in a public setting where I have to give a lecture, et cetera, et cetera. But I know the rules of all those language games, okay? And so what I'm presenting isn't my core self. I'll use my terminology. But I know how to do it, okay? I know what I'm supposed to do and what I'm not supposed to do, and I can do it easily. I can do it smoothly, and I don't even really think about it.
Let's focus on that answer for a second. Sounds like you think, okay, there are ways of being a person. There are ways of being a participant in this context. There are ways for participating in public life. There's ways of giving a lecture. And you, as an agent, take on these ways, right?
Yes.
I mean, I don't know that that's much of... I mean, is there like a way of being... that's a role, but am I just identified with a collection of roles? I mean, that doesn't seem right. I mean, is there like a way of being a Black American such that that's role-like in the way that a teacher is role-like? So my social identities are just a bunch of roles that I take on or put off or...
Well, this is what I call public identities. You are assigned a public identity when you get to be, let's say, an adult or even a teenager. Okay, as a woman, I'm supposed to be a certain way because that's how woman is defined in my culture, okay? Now, I can play with that, and I can, you know, I can reject it, I can accept it, I can do all kinds of things, but when I walk down the street, people are going to see me as a white, middle-class, late middle-aged woman, maybe a professor. I've had people identify me as a professor before I even opened my mouth, you know? There's a public persona out there, and I can't get around it. I mean, I can reject it, I can fight against it, but it's always going to affect my life.
So that gives us a sense of the public persona. Now,
yes.
Gertrude Stein said about Oakland, there's no there there. Now,
yes.
Oakland's a nice place. I don't want to diss Oakland. But I sometimes feel that about people. There's no there there. And in other cases, I feel there is a there there. I mean, just to take contemporary politics, Marco Rubio, I'm not sure there's a there. Bernie Sanders, it's pretty clear there's a there, and he's telling us all about it. Hillary Clinton, somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. So is this a phenomenon? Do some people lack a true self and others have it? And what's the characteristic of people that have a true self, an inner self, even if it's socially constructed, that's somehow more stable, more central, and more who they are than their public persona? What does that involve?
Well, I think it varies. And obviously, you know, when you get into politicians, we're in a whole different realm here.
Yes.
But, you know, and how you present yourself, et cetera. But as I said before, I mean, we all have a core self. We all know who we are. And I think what it comes down to is how much of that we're going to reveal in different settings. I mean, I like to think that Hillary Clinton is a pretty decent person and is, you know, has good qualities and whatever. And if I really sat down and talked to her, I would find that. But you're not going to find it in the news.
So wait a minute. As you say, we all have a core self. I think I want to believe that. But I think I want to believe that. I mean, I sometimes talk about the raw self in some writing of my own about this. But I think I want to believe that. But I have the following trouble. You talk about these roles, these role-like things, you know, the politician's role, the teacher role, and all that sort of stuff that are, you said, assigned. And that sounds like it's top-down or something, from the outward in.
Yeah.
And the core self, Mead thought of that as from the in-out, because it's what responds or something like that. But seriously, I mean, Hillary Clinton talking to you is still one person talking to another, still people assigning roles and responding to one another. I mean, how do you get to this core self? How do you know? Is that the thing you are when you're alone, unsocialized, on an island by yourself? I mean, what is that?
No. Forget islands. Forget metaphysics.
No, it's, I don't want to forget metaphysics.
Okay.
Bracket metaphysics.
Identity is always about sameness. Okay, and the sameness when it comes to the core self is that I'm the same person that I was when I was 20. Okay, there's a continuity there. Okay, and that's what gives you a core self. Is it okay? In my book, I talk about object relations theory, which is psychology, which we don't need to go into. But basically, what happens from all these influences that impinge on you as a young person, you develop an I. Okay, and that I is the same for your entire life. Okay, and that is what I would call the core self. And I think what you may be talking about is the degree to which people are willing to reveal that, okay? And some people are more, you know, quote-unquote, authentic than others.
Now, why do you say it's the same for your entire life? I would think there's a lot of experiences that belie that. I mean, most dramatically, senility, Alzheimer's, when people
go under
transvaluation values.
Yeah,
but even traumatic things, divorces and so forth?
Yeah, but does it really change who you really are? I mean, okay, you're gonna, you know, the knocks of life are gonna get to you, and I was young and idealistic when I was 20, and now I'm really kind of a cynic. But it's still, you know, did you ever have this? When you meet somebody you haven't seen for 30 years.
Yeah. So Susan, I think you're talking about. See, I think there are three things going on here, I do think we need some metaphysics. I think John got at it in his opening. So Susan Heckman has had many different, I don't know you well, stages of life in which you have different sets of preferences and ambitions.
Right.
But all throughout them, you're still Susan Heckman. What makes you Susan Heckman all throughout those things?
Well, see,
that's like personal identity in John's sense from the opening. But then your core self, I think, can still vary even though the person remains. So your core set itself is like a core set of values and expectations and hopes.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. I think so. You know, I mean, I think that it can vary, but the degree, okay, if it really varies, I mean, if it is radically transformed, then probably you have some kind of mental problem.
Well,
yeah,
or something.
Or maybe you've gone over some kind of mental problem.
You're listening to a philosophy talk. We're talking about self and self-presentation. We'd love to have you join this conversation and present yourself to us, real or imagined. And Mary from Los Altos Hills is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Mary.
Oh, hello.
Hello. What's your comment or question, Mary?
This is a great conversation. I know that
it sounds like you were starting to move towards the direction of metaphysics, but I wasn't sure at the place of the Eastern philosophy and the concept of satori experience, you know, sort of the basic enlightenment moments where veils and masks in entirety are dropped and there is a deep connection to the larger, just basic life force without all of, you know, getting into the, you know, the basics of personality and social constructs and personal identity.
Yeah.
It's just like it drops.
Well, Mary, thanks for the question. It's a challenging question because it comes at this from a very different kind of angle and fundamental metaphysics of the self. Because Susan, in the East, in Eastern religions and traditions, there's this thing about transcending the self. That's not a very Western. I mean, this Western debate between the Cartesian and the postmodernism and all that, that's very Western, wouldn't you say?
Oh, most definitely. And I confess I know virtually nothing about Eastern thought, so mm-hmm. you're going to have to help me on that one.
Yeah, but well, that's what I'm saying. That even the postmodernists aren't talking about transcending the self. They're talking about the construction of this self.
Yeah, but I think there's a certain continuity there. I mean, you recognize there's a difference between the basic values and habits and tendencies and dispositions that animate a particular person. And if they're fairly sane, they kind of recognize who those are and they stay fairly stable throughout their life. Then there's the way they present themselves to others when they apply for a job, when they're teaching, when they're on the radio. But from the Eastern perspective, those are a matter of degree. And there is this enlightenment. You call it transcending the self. You might call it getting under the self.
Well,
really,
let me ask,
and realizing it too is not of much significance in the grand scheme of
things. But let me ask a follow-up question about that to turn the conversation back more a little bit back to your expertise. You know, you said, and this always bothers me a little bit in the postmodern, you said the self is, you talked about being assigned these various social roles.
Yes.
You're talking
yes.
about developing yes. into them because your parents and all that sort of stuff. That all sounds like it takes place without my doing.
Yeah.
It's somehow put on me.
Yes.
But one of the things that the old Enlightenment and leading up to the Enlightenment philosophers believed in deeply is autonomy. And autonomy is a form of self-ownership and self-construction. And I have this possibility of configuring myself perhaps against the social world that's trying to configure me in one way. And that liberation is what makes that possible. Do the postmodernists reject that as all just...
Yes, they do. And that is a problem. I haven't worked that one out yet. That's going to be my next book.
Well, you have some groping thoughts about that.
And Foucault is a big one here. I mean, it's a script. You're given a script, and you literally perform the script, and that's all there is, okay? And you're right. That leaves out choice. It leaves out agency. It leaves out autonomy. And that's a very difficult question to answer. And the only way I can do it is to say, yes, we have this script, and that script is not of my making. It is, you know, I was born into it. But within that script, I can make choices. I mean, look at it this way. Think about how different people perform Hamlet, okay? There's a script there, right? And you got to read the script and all of that. But think of the different, you know, ways in which a Hamlet comes across given how you as an actor interpret that script, okay? And I know that's probably going to sound kind of weak, but that's the best that I can do right
now. So let me ask you a question that intrigues me. Why are so many of these postmodernists who don't really believe in it exhibit A for strong-willed, decisive, centrally organized people that won't change their mind even
right.
in light of my good arguments?
Right, that's true. and you're one of the people I talked to in your organization said that you've had Judith Butler on, and
we love Judith.
Yes. And she's obviously, if you're in feminism, she's the origin of all of this. But I would argue that she herself is moving in the direction more of what I'm talking about. Of saying there is, I would go so far as to say that in her recent work there is a there. All right,
and that's good.
Yeah, no, I don't know if Judith would go along with that, and maybe she's listening right now.
She moved from Oakland to Berkeley.
1-800-525-9917. And Stephen from Davis is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephen.
Oh, hi. I was just calling because I read recently about these two identical twins that were separated early in their lives, I think at birth or so. And they grew up to be extremely different. One grew up in Nazi Germany, the other one did not, and both were Jews, actually. I think that when they met, like 30 years later, they had the same neat mustaches, they had the same haircut, they had the same kind of clothing, colors, they had the same kind of sense of humor. So they exhibited a core self that is like indisputable, objectively measured. I'm wondering whether that factors into this discussion you've had, which you haven't really talked about, sort of twins, people who are essentially identical and how they form their true selves as well.
So would you be willing to accept a slight revision? They clearly had interesting similarities that emerged even after all these years. But it's not so clear that we would call those things like the mustache and the sense of humor the real core, would we?
Yeah, that's what I was going to add too, Stephen. And I thank you for the call. And I wonder, Susan, what do you think? I mean, there are. It seems plausible to me. It doesn't seem plausible to some really postmodernists. But there seems plausible to me that there are biological determinants of our selfhood. But it doesn't seem plausible to me that those come close to exhausting the self.
I agree wholeheartedly. I mean, what we're leaving out of this discussion, and what postmoderns leave out of the discussion, is what we now talk about is the material, okay? You have a brain, okay? And that brain has certain characteristics. And I think that if we go down that road, we can explain the identical twins, et cetera. But you can't leave out social conditioning. It's just so massively important that I think what we ought to do is come up with a theory that merges the two so that we can talk about the material and the biological in the brain, and we can talk about the social, and we can say together that's what forms the self.
I totally agree with you, except I want to add one thing, and then we'll take a break really quickly. I think you're right, the material and the social, but there's also this Mead-like thing that I think can't be lost sight of. The ability within me to take in and respond to what others throw at me. This I-ness that is not exhausted either by the mere biology or by the social construction that comes at me. So I think that's really complicated, but we'll talk more about that. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about private and public personas, self and self-representation with Susan Heckman from the University of Texas at Arlington.
In our final segment, we're going to explore the new politics of identity. Some say identity politics is antithetical to the spirit of democratic liberalism. Others believe that to ignore identity in politics is to silence the marginalized and reward the privileged. Should identity politics be celebrated or avoided?
The politics of identity, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Identity politics can be hard to navigate. You may find yourself being labeled as something you yourself don't identify with at all. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Including your identity, but except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Susan Heckman, author of Private Selves, Public Identities. And we're thinking about the self and our self-presentation.
Susan, I'm pretty much a liberal progressive. Now, I'm an old liberal progressive, but sometimes I think I'm an old-fashioned liberal progressive. I mean, I've got to admit that I find it hard to keep up with the demands of the new identity politics. I know how to check my male privilege and my white privilege, but now I've got to check my cis privilege, too. I don't think I have a homophobic bone in my body, but you know, I'm not sure I'm not heteronormative. As a matter of fact, I didn't even know what heteronormative meant till Ken explained it to me this morning after reading some of this stuff. I came up with this question. So am I heteronormative? I don't know. All of which leads me to wonder whether our obsession with identity politics, if it's kind of pushing a good old liberal like me out the side door, hasn't gotten a little bit out of hand. What do you think?
Well, I hate to tell you this, but yes, it is pushing you out the door. And what I argue is that identity politics is changing liberalism, literally, because liberal politics is grounded on the notion of what some people have called the universal citizen. We are all the same when we enter the political realm. One man, one vote. We're all equal before the law. There's no room for identity because identity is the bad old stuff that was in the Middle Ages. Okay, now we're all equal and everybody's the same. Only we're not. What we've discovered is that universal citizen is white male property owner, okay? And that's been hidden, you know, veiled, if you want to put it that way, for all this time. Bringing identity into the liberal polity violates the basic presuppositions of the liberal polity, and it changes everything. And I'm here to say, go for it. I think it's great.
Well, let's slow down a little bit. I understand why some people would say that. But, a more nuanced form of liberalism says that, look, all of us have what I call ground-level projects tied up with our identity. I'm a black guy, you're a white person, you're a Christian, I'm a Jew. Blah, blah, blah. We all have these ground-level projects. But when we come together in political life, we have to have, and we're going to empower a state, we have to have the state empowered to act on all of us, independently of our sectarian identity. So it's not that we don't have the identities, it's just that we don't use those identities to give the state reasons to use its coercive powers over other people, right? It's what Rawls calls the public reasons constraint. So it's not that says you can't have an identity, it's just that you can't make the state adopt a rationale based on your Christianity or your aversion to gays or whatever, right? All citizens in their multiple identities have to be equal before the power of the state.
But of course, we white males didn't really have to impose this on the state. It was was founded on that assumption, right?
Right. So I just think it's more complicated than that.
Well, it is more complicated, but treating unequals equally perpetuates inequality. I wish I'd come up with that, but somebody more famous than I came up with that. But what I think makes sense is this philosopher I love, Irish Marion Young, and what she argues is that we need a politics of difference. So instead of treating everybody equally, what we need to do is to treat people in their different situations so that some groups are going to get more or less than other groups so that we can bring everyone up to a level playing field. And we can't do that by giving everybody the same thing, okay? I mean, look at recent politics in the United States, particularly with regard to African Americans. I mean, it's not working, okay? We need a new politics. We need a politics that recognizes difference and acts on it.
How does this work exactly? Take the civil rights movement, the old old civil rights movement, bought into classical liberalism because it said to America that we want to hold you to the true meaning of your creed, that all people are created equal. You're not be judged by the content of your, but you'll be judged by the content of your character, not by the, you know, that's like, we want to hold you to this old-fashioned liberal idea of true equality of all before all, independently of identity. Now, it sounds like a contemporary movement would say, well, that's not sufficient, but I'm not quite sure what would be sufficient. I'm not quite sure what's being suggested. Suppose that the civil rights movement were reframed in terms of the new identity politics. What would it look like?
Well, I think it would look a whole lot different, because what you were trying to do in the old civil rights movement was just, okay, we want to be treated equally. Well, that's not working out, you know? So maybe what we need to do is give disadvantaged African Americans, give them something special that we don't give to the rest of the population. And that goes against the grain of liberalism,
right,
as well it should. You know, we have to do something about the Fergusons and the Baltimores, and it needs special attention, and it needs a different politics. We can't just treat everybody equally, because first of all, we're not treating everybody equally, and secondly, it's not working.
Well, the thing you said we're not treating everybody equally. So we're violating the norm of equality. And so why isn't just, I'm not quite sure why it's not just enough to live up to the norm of equality. Since we're not treating everybody equally, and since that's the demand of classical liberalism, that independently of invidious distinctions between people, they all be treated as equal citizens. Now, what does it mean to treat somebody as an equal citizen? It means not to put in barriers in their direction that aren't in their direction. So if black people are subject to, like, discriminatory voting practices, remove those.
Okay, but would that solve the problem of the African-American community in the United States?
Well, that's a good question.
If they were, okay, if the police stopped profiling, if they stopped, you know, harassing blacks, would that solve the problem of the black community in the United States? No, it wouldn't. They need more than that. They need special programs that are going to give them jobs and education. Think about education, you know? It's just, special programs have to come in order to eradicate the differences that cripple us as a polity.
But you would know? You really want to deny those programs to impoverished white children?
No, definitely not. No.
Well, then you're kind of really, based on that, it sounds like you believe in equality, not just treat everyone the same, but treat everyone that fits into the same relevant class the same, where the relevant class really isn't determined by race.
You know, there would be a lot of different programs for different people, and that's something that makes a lot of people really nervous.
Yeah, okay. So let's ask another question along these similar lines, just to see how this all works out. I mean, I'm just playing with ideas at the moment. I don't have any fixed opinions. People, you say, treat blacks differently, but a black person is simultaneously a gay person, can be a poor person, can be a rich person, can be an upper middle class educated person. I mean, my son, you know, I hope, has lots of advantages. He has some disadvantages. He's still subject to racial profiling, but he went to really good schools, and he has pretty well-off parents, and he goes to an elite university. He has lots of advantages. He's a lot different. There are many elements of his identity that he doesn't share with an inner city person from failing schools and of whatever race.
Yes. So, I'm sorry, but your son would have to be excluded from from those policies. I mean, it's a matter of as one person putting it, taking the risk of difference.
No, but what I'm wondering about is if, not so much about the policies, but given the fluidity of identity and the multiplicity of identity, and that take any group of people and they're going to vary along many different dimensions, how do we get to say which are the relevant identities for the purposes of identity politics?
Not an easy question to answer. And that's one of the, I think, very strong arguments against identity politics, is it slots everybody into one and only one category. And that's something that we have to be very careful about, okay? I mean, there's all kinds of differences among women, among African Americans, et cetera, and we have to have policies that take that into consideration. I don't need a lot of the things that women who don't have my self-confidence and my good education, et cetera, need. So I don't really have to have a special program. But some women do. Some women are just need a lot more help than men do.
You know, if I were a conservative, which I'm not, but I hear their voices sometimes, they would, one conservative criticism of identity politics is based kind of on what you say, right? People call the race pimpers, the this pimpers, the that, you know, because they assume, like conservative blacks say, people assume that blackness goes with liberalism or this or that.
Right.
And there are people who benefit off that. So identity politics gets caught up in all this stuff that we argue over.
Right.
Precisely because it's hard to decide which are the salient identities for what purposes.
Again, I appeal to some other philosopher much smarter than me who says what we need to do is we need a politics of not who I am, but what I want. Okay? So for certain political issues, I'm going to say I'm a woman or I'm an African American or whatever because I want this. And other political issues, I want other things, and I'm going to identify with different groups of people in order to accomplish that. I know this all sounds very unformed, and it is, and that's exactly the point, is if we're going to change liberalism in a fundamental way, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be overnight. We're going to have to really work at it, and it's not going to be tomorrow.
Okay, now, Susan, unfortunately, we're at the end of this. I'd love to. We're just getting started in something really deep and really interesting.
How many hours do you want to go?
we'll have you back another time because this is really fascinating and deep and interesting stuff. But I got to thank you for joining us now.
You're most welcome. I enjoyed it.
Our guest has been Susan Heckman. She's a professor of political science at the University of Texas at Arlington. She's author of Private Selves, Public Identities, Reconsidering Identity Politics. So, John, what are you thinking today? What's your self-identification or presentation today?
What am I thinking today? I'm actually curious about the difference between France and America. You think of France as kind of the leader of postmodernism, but the French are less tolerant about celebrating different identities. They don't allow Arabic women to wear burqas, I guess, or at least not out in public. In America, we wouldn't think of doing that. So I'm not sure I yet understand the geography of postmodernism, probably never will.
Well, that's a really good question. France is very, very serious about the secular state and not letting any sectarian intrusions into that. And we're a little less serious about that. And you're right. Who's more postmodern, France or so that's a good question. This is a great conversation. I mean, there's lots and lots and lots more to talk about. I really do think we should do a follow-up show with Susan. But you know what? This conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is old-fashioned liberalism, cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. And you can become a partner in that community by visiting our webpage at philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear the very private thoughts of a very public persona. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, maybe the self as we know it didn't really come into existence until the mid-20th century. It existed, but you couldn't monetize it, could you? Now, sure, you had your Freud, the voyages to self-discovery, but it was an elite process. You had to live in the city where all the shrinks were, have the money to pay for one. Then came the suburbs and disposable income and GI Bill college educations and the baby boom. There was suddenly a forest of selves and a market for self-discovery. Even if you didn't have something wrong with you, you'd develop a syndrome right quick. In the 60s, psychology collided with social science and capitalism. We got jargony books that took off in the marketplace, like The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life by Irving Goffman, which posited that we all have roles to play all the time and we are our own audiences. It hit a nerve, gave drama to our dreary daily lives. And of course there was 1964's Games People Play by psychiatrist Eric Byrne, which sold more than 5 million copies. Back in the 19th century, it was all self-confidence and self-reliance, and then neurosis reared its ugly head, kind of a byproduct of success. Instead of conquering the West or building skyscrapers and railroads, we were off on an inner journey. By the 60s, we could escape the self, ease the burden of self, find our true self, lose ourself, help the self. The term identity crisis left the field of psychology to become a bogus social issue. You hate your job? Well, that's normal. Don't quit. See a therapist. Now, well, that's passé. We don't have jobs anymore. And we don't have identity crises. No, we are hardwired is what we are. The quest has become to find that wiring. You can identify as whatever you believe you truly are. People with penises identify as female. People without penises identify as male. You can do that. We have identity politics on the left. People of color find their voice. And on the right, Christian identity politics. White people find their guns. Schools might not have arts or music programs, but they all have grief counselors. Oh, brave new world that has such identities in it. Self-help programs like Est and Lifespring and Ayn Rand goosed us into our present self-questing situation. Be who you are, not the role imposed upon you. Est was so successful, the founder, Werner Erhard, let it go and began the Hunger Project, whose aim was to end world hunger by 1997. Didn't happen because the Hunger Project's main project was to raise consciousness around the issues of world hunger. Well, mission accomplished. That's what we have today. Massive consciousness raising all the time, every day, imposing ourselves in a self-driven world. We call them selfies, don't we? Yes, we do. But is anybody really paying attention to us? Well, it doesn't matter, just so it seems like somebody is. Amazon knows who we are, for instance, or at least what we might want based on what we wanted last time we checked in. Algorithms? Palgorithms. Just the other day, I read an article about selfhood issues. The author called herself a struggling fat bisexual black Afro-Latin Muslim student. Well, that's a lot of self to carry around. Used to be a victim, then a survivor, and now a struggling warrior. Me, I'm just a mouthy, aging, heteronormative white guy. Pity me. I can't even check my privilege. All the mouthy, aging, heteronormative white guy air has been sucked right out of the room. Thanks, Donald Trump. Thanks for nothing. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2015.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Thanks also to Ted Muldoon, Merle Kessler, Erica Topit, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Sometimes I think you say things just to hear yourself talk.
What do you want me to do, ignore myself?